sir. Oh, very good. So, there are no questions today. Little up. Anyway, here we go. Our first question. What do you think of this? No, good question. No, yeah, okay. In some beliefs, there are chants that transmit mute energy, or these chants then manifesting desires, which grows the ego. Transmutes energy. I don't know. You get sort of energy into mass. I don't know that physics. So that's true, because when I do chanting, I get food, and that transmutes into mass. I don't know if that's what you mean. But, yeah, sometimes that when we are meditating, yes, that's the time to let go of wanting. But we still have to have some desires sometimes. If you gave up all of your desires, all of your wanting, then you would never get back to Singapore. And you have to want to actually pack your bags, and in a few days' time, want to get on the car, want to do stuff. So the point is that when we say, let go, you don't always let go. I always tell people that if you're, say, on a motorbike on Orchard Road, attach. Otherwise, you'll fall off. So, there are chants and there are chants. And they just, how do chants work? I know they work. You go and cheer on Singapore playing Indonesia. Or Indonesia plays, and if it's a home game, you really chant, and you chant, and you chant. Of course, it inspires people. And you can see just that much. It works. So sometimes, the chanting can actually be quite powerful. It can encourage a person. There's actually much more than that. Sometimes there are some weird stuff which comes from chanting. Anyway, at Nibbana everything ceases, including peace and bliss and happiness. If so, it doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound good, but it feels good. So sometimes people, they think, oh, it doesn't sound good. Even like for people in your office, coming to Jhana Grove, when you've got a week off, you can go anywhere in the world. And you're not eating in the evening, no TVs. You say, well, that doesn't sound good. But it is good. This is one of the things that sometimes they say, it's one of the sayings. What enlightened people say is happiness. The world said is suffering. What enlightened ones say is suffering, people say is happiness. You get it the wrong way around. So after a while, when everything ceases, first of all, you can't understand that, it doesn't make any sense. But little by little, when you taste some freedom, you taste a bit of cessation, ooh, that's really nice. So, little by little, one starts to taste freedom, cessation, and there, you realize why the Buddha taught cessation. At what stage of meditation can I see past lives? You can see past lives right now. This afternoon, you... Now, if it's like your previous lives, where you were before, that is usually just when the five hindrances have been suppressed. And that's, see, in other words, when, you know, you're really peaceful, you can feel some energy in your mindfulness, you know, really strong energy. And you just, a bit of fearlessness as well. And you just ask yourself, What's my earliest memory? And if you're ready for it, it comes up straight away. You don't have to keep asking. Because when your mind is very still and powerful, when you can look at the floor, the bamboo, and say, wow, look at that. Amazing. When you go and see the blade of grass, or the baked bean, just one baked bean, whoa. When you can do things like that, then the mind is ready to see the past lives. What were you in the previous life? Just a bunch of five components of existence. During your talk, you mentioned about yourself meditating in your cave. Will the retreatants have an opportunity to visit and meditate in your cave? There was this, I forget what her name was. She's a nun, but before she was a nun, she was with her boyfriend trekking in the foothills of the Himalaya mountains. And as she was trekking there, they came across a cave. And so she decided to meditate in front of the cave. And her boyfriend, he meditated on a rock above the cave. And they didn't think anyone was there. In fact, there was no one in the cave because the bear was out. But then the bear came back and she saw this girl meditating in front of his cave. Now, not all bears are like this. These are nice bears, but those bears, they got so jealous. And the bear attacked her. And he got the really big bear because it got her head in its jaws, like this. And she said, well, she visited here some time ago, and you can actually see the scars around her scalp. So
she
said, no, of course, she wouldn't be able to tell me that if she did die. But one thing she said, which was really interesting, a nice thing to know, is that she didn't feel any pain, but she was almost overcome by the stink of that bear's breath. Because the bears do not brush their teeth. And she said, that was the worst thing. It's really stank. And then, what did she do? She said, no, her boyfriend was no use. But she said, started doing some chanting. She did some chanting. And you know, that must have been very, very powerful chanting, because the bear, after doing the chanting, the bear just opened its jaws and ran off and let her be free. But you know, she was really badly injured, lots of blood. And her boyfriend then came to the rescue once the bear was gone. And managed to sort of carry her down to the nearest village to get some treatments. So she survived, okay, a bit sick. But then she had headaches. And no one knew why she had a headache. Until, I think she was in England somewhere, and they took her to have a CT scan. And you know what they found inside? Sorry? What? Now what they found inside, there was a little plant growing in her brain. A tiny plant. Because what had happened, the bear had been eating some sort of seeds or whatever, and had actually planted, when it sort of bit her, had actually planted a little seed, a tiny invisible, oh, not visible, but a tiny seed in her brain, and it started to grow. So this little, it was germinated inside her brain. She had a plant inside her brain. But of course, you know, they weren't very sort of, what's it called, environmentally sensitive, so they took the plant out. They didn't say what the plant was, but I was wondering whether it was a Bodhi tree. Because that would have been very good. But anyway, that was what happened. So be careful of that cave. Because You know, the owner is out at the moment, but if the owner comes back... Yeah, of course, I mean, you can go and visit it sometime. You can organise the official tour of the cave. Dear Ajahn, I am so much afraid of ghosts, even though I have never seen one. You know why you haven't seen one? Because they're more afraid of you than they are. Anyway, when I'm alone during night time, this happens. Please help to enlighten me how to get rid of this fear of ghosts. If a ghost comes, you tell them, listen, you're not allowed in this place. If you don't get out now, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm. Because ghosts are very afraid of monks. Really afraid. So I know this one monk who, he went looking for the ghosts over in Wat Nanachat, found a few, and as soon as they saw him, they were just terrified. What, you can see us? Because monks have more power. Even you have more power than ghosts. Why are elephants afraid of mice? Crazy, isn't it? Can a mouse hurt an elephant? But the elephant can squash a mouse just like that. Squash. Hamburger patty. Or chocolate mousse. I don't know. But anyway, why is it that the elephants are afraid of... It doesn't make any sense. Same as why human beings are afraid of ghosts. You are higher beings. So you don't need to be afraid of ghosts. So it's one of those... Remember that story. And when I was with... in the... Psychic Research Society with Professor Bernard Carr. We used to go hunting ghosts. And a lot of time, this Psychic Research Society had been going for over 100 years even then. It's over 130, 40 years now. And there's never, ever been a case where a ghost has hurt anybody. So, you know, these are scientists and this is research, really strong research. Yeah, there's ghosts. Very rare. Most of the time you don't even notice them. But the ghosts never hurt you. In fact, the ghosts can be very helpful. I know you remember, what's his name, in Metta Lodge in Johor. Dr. Wong, something, what Wong? Sorry? Yeah. But anyway, because he does some of his work in the old hospital built by the British in JB. And that's a very old hospital. There's lots of ghosts in there. And I asked him one day, he said, well, what's the best ghost story in the old hospital in JB, Johor Bahru? And he said, oh yeah, he was doing an operation one day, you know, in the operating theatre, you know, which is obviously has to be very, very secure. And, you know, he was really focusing on the operation. And he asked the nurse for tweezers or scalpel or something. So, you know, he asked the nurse, and so the nurse gave him some scalpel or tweezers or something, but then he noticed the nurse was on the other side of the table. There's no one behind him. But somebody gave him some tweezers or needle. The ghost did. They're very helpful because sometimes you don't get enough people, you know, these days, helping in the operating theatre. The hospital's always cutting down costs. So having a few ghosts around to help you out is really, really helpful. But of course, I was in one of the books, you know, the tsunami ghost. You all know that story. You don't? Okay, it's a nice story. Good ending. This was known as tsunami many years. What is it? How many years ago was that now? 8 years? 9 years? 14 years. Doesn't time fly? But anyway, a couple of days after the tsunami, there was a Thai girl over in the town of Grabi, you know, which is, you know, south of Thailand, but, you know, a bit of a way from the main areas where the tsunami hit. And she had this dream, middle of the night. And the dream was this English girl came to see her. Help me. Help me. Help me. I'm dead. And that was a dream, so she, you know, she didn't sort of wake up or run away. But in the dream, this girl, you can, you know, see that she said, I was on Phi Phi Island. You know, that's just off Phuket. You know, when the big wave hit. I'm dead. She said, my mother is ringing me right now, but my cell phone's on the bottom of the ocean. Help me. And, you know, that she said, right now my body's been taken and put into one of the temples, the wats, in Phuket Island, because that's they use those as temporary morgues. And she said, my mum's trying to contact me, please tell her that I'm dead. And can you please arrange a Buddhist cremation and tell my mum not to come and see me like this, all gashed and bloody and bruised. Tell her to come and collect the ashes afterwards. And here's my mum's telephone number. And at that, the girl woke up. And her husband was right next to her in bed, so he woke her husband up. And the husband actually recognised that was the London telephone number. And he said, oh, ring it, call it. And of course, being a tiger, he said, no way, you ring. Because it was a ghost. So anyway, they called the number. And it was, you know, the mum. She recognised, she knew that that was her daughter. And she also knew that, she already knew that she was died. Because, you know, mums, mothers, daughters, if something happens, you know that something's up. And so she gave permission to cremate the body. So the next day, this was in the middle of the night. The next day they went over to Phuket, to the temple, which they said in the dream. And they got permission to go in there because it was chaos. And she saw the body exactly as she saw in the dream. This young English girl, blonde hair, but all bruised and battered and clothes ripped. They got permission to, you know, identified her and then got permission to cremate her. And then called the mum. And the mum came over to collect the ashes. And thanked this couple, this English man and his Thai wife. And then went back to London with the ashes. And the next night, the girl had a dream again. This Thai girl. This time, the girl in the dream, the English girl, this time she looked immaculate, like she'd just been to the best hairdresser in town, and just had like the, I don't know what the girls do to make themselves look sort of nice, clear skin, no gashes, no wounds, just perfect skin, and a beautiful dress on, smiling. She said, thank you so much, look what you've done for me. I can never thank you enough. And thank you for looking after my mother. Thank you so much. And then the ghost, or Deva, now, gave this Thai girl another set of numbers. And it was not telephone number. It was lottery number. And it won. They made a small fortune, actually quite a fortune. So that's the true story. The moral of the story is, if a ghost comes to see you, do not run away until they give you some numbers. And then run away. There's true stories. I've got lots of really nice ghost stories where ghosts really help people. Anyway, Guru Arjan Parama, I know you've mentioned this before, but please explain again how to not disturb the noise. Meditation is best done in a complete silent atmosphere, but Singapore is a very noisy place. How do you shut off the noise? It's just, you don't pay attention to it. It's just noise, that's all. You don't try and listen to it to find out who's saying what or what it is, whether it's an aircraft or whether it's one of those jets from the Air Force or whether it's the neighbour. Whether it's people arguing, what they're arguing about, you just don't show interest to the noise. It's just noise. And don't try and stop it. Because if you try and stop it, the noise is in your head. If it's in your cottage, somebody bangs the door, and then you start thinking, why did they bang the door? They should be more sensitive. This is a meditation retreat. If they can't be mindful and close the door silently, or at least softly, you know, what's the point of them being in this meditation retreat? You know, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, people should learn to be more sensitive. And you find that the door finished slamming a long time ago, and it's still echoing in your head hours afterwards. The real noise is not the slamming of the door, but it's your reaction to it. That's the real noise. So that's the noise that you have disturbed, the noise, by allowing it to continue in your mind. Sometimes hours, sometimes days, sometimes years, after the real noise has dissipated and finished. So that's how not to disturb the noise. Just noise. Now after a while you don't hear it anymore. Why is it that people who live on like flight paths, or they live next to a busy road, or they live next to, I don't know, you don't hear it after a while. It's like you get used to it. You don't pay attention to it and it vanishes. So that is, you don't need a completely silent atmosphere. You need a mind which doesn't resonate with the noise. Do you remember that simile I said of a guitar string, which is not stretched, which is really loose, something hits it and it doesn't echo, it doesn't resonate. So that's when you don't disturb the noise. In the seven factors of awakening, equanimity is the last factor. Is this upeka the same quality as the upeka in the Brahma-viharas? How does equanimity act as a factor in enlightenment? Are these seven factors sequential? Yeah, they are sequential, because once you start to get your mindfulness, that allows you to explore things. If you're not really aware, if you're just sleepwalking, then of course you don't know where you're going. And you might fall into the pond down below there, but don't worry, in the pond there are no crocodiles down there. Crocodile Dundee lives up in Queensland. Over here there are no crocodiles at all. Just the ducks. And the ducks are very Buddhist and they don't attack you. We do not have psychotic ducks in this So anyway, so once you get the mindfulness, then, you know, you can get some exploration of the Dhamma, because you're aware, it gets bright, penetrating, and you can see things which you never expected before. And then, when you get the exploration of the Dhamma, what's the next one? You get some energy. Sorry? Joy and energy. Says it. We know it's energy, yeah. And that energy, the word for energy here is like virya. And knowing some Pali, it comes from the word vira, which is like hero. It's almost like heroic energy. Like the simile was like the person who goes into battle for the king, and they're willing to sacrifice anything. They're not trying to protect themselves from injury or death. They just got a job to do and they sacrifice everything. That's the idea of like energy or virya. It's like almost heroic sacrifice. You do anything, you know, for the sake of, in this case, truth. So it's not, you know, what's in it for me. It's like giving, letting go, that type of energy. And then you get this beautiful joy, the piety. And that joy obviously comes up when you're not thinking of yourself. You really are letting go. You're giving, not expecting anything back in return. You get really lots of joy and happiness. When it's, what am I getting out of this? You don't get so much happiness. That's why sometimes when you employ somebody, you pay them, that, you know, sometimes, right, I'm finished, I'm going home. But, you know, if it's, you know, for, if you're really doing it for something bigger, higher cause, that people just really, really work hard. And they keep giving, giving, giving. Just like I always mention during retreats, that when this place was built, I think on Waysack 2000, and I think it was 9 years ago, 2009, that the builders said, oh, we're going to finish in plenty of time. And of course, what happens? The night before the opening ceremony, they're still working hard. Well, not the afternoon, and then they knocked off. They weren't going to, even though it wasn't finished, they went home. And this part of the flooring had not been completed yet. It was just concrete. And it was late in the afternoon. All the builders had gone home. And we're having the opening ceremony the next day. So, what did we do? The monks. My slaves. I didn't ask them. They said, yeah, we'll give it a go. And so, this portion over here, they worked until about 4 o'clock in the morning, laying it, finishing it off. So in the morning we could have the ceremony. And after the ceremony, started the first meditation retreat here. And they did a really good job. And this is what happens when you do it, because it's not for money. It's because giving it needs to be done. Service. That's so much joy you get out of that. And you do a great job too. And so that was the pity. And then when you have beautiful joy, you get tranquil, you're satisfied, you don't want things. You've got enough joy. And of course, after the joy, pity, prasati, and then you get the stillness. Oh, yeah. And then after the stillness, you see things as they truly are, and you get equanimous, you don't disturb the noise. People, do stupid things. Sometimes I do stupid things. What's the stupidest thing I've done this year? What? Sorry? You can tell me a few, probably. But I was just telling somebody a few days ago, I know today, I think, that just when you do chanting, sometimes you get the chanting wrong. Like the time when there was doing a wedding and doing the chanting, and I was really tired. And instead of doing the usual chanting for weddings, I did the chanting for funerals by mistake. The death chanting. And that's one of the reasons we chant in Pali. So you don't understand what we're chanting. So if I make mistakes, you don't know. So I realized I already started this young couple and I was chanting for them. And I started the funeral chanting. What am I going to do? So I just carried on. And they're still married. They're still doing very well. So you make mistakes like that. But one of the worst mistakes which I did, doing chanting. And chanting does have some power. I was invited up to the ICU in the hospital here. I think it was the Royal Perth Hospital. And because it was a Chinese family, their patriarch, their old grandfather, was really sick in the ICU, was dying. And they wanted me to come and do some chanting, and so I rushed in there. You've got to be careful when you rush, because, I didn't get any background about, what was going on. So I just got there, saw this man who was in a coma, and he was just really, really, really sick. And I just really gave it full power, full blast, super power chanting. And it worked. Now he recovered. And, the doctor said, well, amazing, a miracle. We thought he was going to die, but, it looks like he's okay. And that's where I got into really big trouble. Because all the family had come from various parts. They'd come from Singapore, from Hong Kong, and from Taiwan, and all over the place. And they'd come for the funeral. They'd even arranged a funeral. And I come along, and they have to all go back home again. After just wasted so much money and taken time off work, saying their father is dying and he's not going to die after all. And they lost a lot of money on that, and they really scolded me. They said, Ajahn Brahm, we want you to ask you to chant so he had a peaceful death, not that he recovered. You did the wrong chanting again. They scolded me. So from that time on, when people ask for chanting, I always ask, first of all, what type of chanting do you want? Get better chanting or die peaceful chanting. There's a difference. So I made a mistake there. So anyway, but you make a mistake, you're upeka, and you just leave it alone, you're just equanimous. What should I do after being mindful of my breath? Is that blue? Bleh? Now, what you should do after being mindful of whatever is learn how to write carefully. Is it breath? Must be breathing or whatever. Is it to into the oh, what's the cessation of it? Oh, the feeling. What should I do after being mindful of my feelings? Is it to contemplate who the feeling arose and what the cessation of it is? Don't do anything. Don't contemplate it. Just might be similar this afternoon of just the water. You just allow the feeling, allow the mind to explore into the feeling. Don't tell it what to do. If you tell it what to do, you just do old stuff you've done before. Here you actually explore in different ways. This is where you actually see right into the feeling what it actually is. What is experience? So you're mindful of your feeling, which means you're just getting aware of it. You're gathering information, gathering data, you explore it, and as such, it can be quite sort of insightful. So don't do anything. Just leave it there and see what happens. Ajahn, what may I do when I have awareness of craving? It is like a little kid crying for candy. His mum said no candy, but the kid keeps crying until he wears down her resistance. The craving seems to get stronger the longer it lasts. What should I do? Like mind hunger, craving for taste. Ah, sometimes if you are craving, want something, you always know that it's just like you're thirsty and you drink salty water. You know, you're just even more thirsty afterwards. So where does craving want? So sometimes you say, well, why do I want this? You investigate, explore craving and wanting. What actually is it? Sometimes it's not that you actually want the object of your craving. It's just, that's the only thing you know what to do is to want in life. If you're not doing something, you know, you look for something to want. I used to notice that when I was a kid, or not a kid, but just a young man, you go visit your mum, and you know, you'd look in the refrigerator. There's nothing to eat, even though it was full, chock-a-block with food, and nothing to eat. Even those days, you go and turn on the TV, it's about 3 channels, nothing on TV. These days, there's 160 channels, nothing on TV. What's going on there? It's just, it's not that you want something, it's just you're restless. And if you get it, it doesn't satisfy you. You just want something else, want something more. It's a continuous just fleeing away from contentment. The simile is of a prisoner who's been in jail for so many years. And tomorrow they're going to be free. When they can't sleep all night. Not because of excitement, because of fear. And in the end they just don't want to be free. They're not used to freedom. They're used to wanting. Always wanting something more. How much do you want? And if we give it to you, will that satisfy you? Or do you want something more? Look at someone, you know, like a Donald Trump. You know, billionaire. What on earth does he want to be president of the United States for? There's so much problem and trouble and, you know, it's crazy wanting to be in power. You got other people like Warren Buffett. He's got plenty of money. What does he want to keep working for? Who's the other people? Like Zuckerberg. You know, just as a young man, he's just got Facebook going, billionaire. Why doesn't he just let somebody else, you know, just carry on the company so he can just relax? All this wanting. So it brings me up to the old simile of the Mexican fisherman, which is one of the favourite ones. So, if you don't know this story, it's in Open the Door of Your Heart. So once upon a time there was this Mexican fisherman, and he went out in the morning in his little boat, caught some fish, and he was unloading his catch when there was an American, had to be an American, tourist on vacation, just was watching him. And the tourist came up to him after he'd unloaded his catch and said, what are you doing now? Just making conversation. He said, oh, I've caught enough fish for the day. Now I'm going to go home and have lunch with my wife. After lunch, have a nap, have a siesta. And after siesta, I'll be at home when my kids come back from school, play with my kids, help them with the homework. And then in the evening after dinner, I might go out to the cantina, like the bar, and just have a couple of tequilas, not get drunk, play some guitar, just have a nice little time with my friends. Life is good. And then the tourist said, you are wasting a precious resource, your boat, laying idle all afternoon and all night. He said, I am a professor of business studies from a big university in the United States. I can give you some advice for free. You go home and have lunch with your wife, but after lunch, go out and do some work. You know, you're not living up to your earning potential. Go and do something in the afternoon. Then you can catch twice as many fish. With twice as many fish, you have twice the profit. You will soon have enough money to hire some crew. And with a crew, you can catch four times as much fish. Then you'll be able to buy a bigger boat with more crew and get even more fish. Your profits will go up. And then you'll be able to buy a second boat after 2 or 3 years. And then after about 5 years, a whole fleet of boats. And then you can move your business headquarters to Mexico City. And then you can float your company, not on the ocean, but on the stock market. And do an IPO, is that right? Yeah. Oh, that's good. I actually learned that one. What is it? Initial public offering. And of course you give yourself share options and buyback options and everything else, which I don't really understand, but then you could sell your company or sell your share options, cash in, and you'll be a millionaire. Or something like that. You probably understand more than I do about this stuff. You can be a multimillionaire. And the fisherman was listening to him patiently and said, yes, but then what would I do with all those millions? And the professor said, well, you know, when you're a millionaire, you can, I don't know, maybe you can retire. Retire to a nice little peaceful fishing village like this. You can buy yourself a little boat to go out in the morning for fun. Catch a few fish. You'll be able to have lunch with your wife every day. Have a nice, no stress nap after lunch. You'll always be there with your kids to play with them. And then in the evening, you can actually relax with your friends in the cantina. But I do that already, said the fisherman. Why is it we want to make a fortune so we can live like a poor person? With no job, peaceful, with lots of time. What do you want? So cry for things which you want. So the second story, because I like stories, and yeah, okay. That was the story of the abbot, head of the temple, and in the morning, about 3 o'clock, he was woken up. Someone was in the shrine room, and it was somewhere in the morning. He said, "No, that's not one of my monks getting up that early." So he got up, and he looked, and it was a burglar. The burglar was raiding the donation box. And the burglar had his big sharp knife. And as soon as the burglar saw the monk, he said, "Keep away, or I'll knife you." And the monk said, "Well, what do you want?" "Ah, shut up, I warned you once." And then the monk saw that he needed, he was trying to open the box, the donation box with the knife. So the monk put his hand in his pocket and took out the key. "Here, use this, this is the key."
"Is this a trick?"
"No, it's a key. Those are donations which are supposed to help people. So, you know, you're obviously poor, you need it, so take it." So he, you know, tossed the key to the burglar, and the burglar, still holding the knife, pointed to the monk, opened the donation box, and filled his pockets with cash. And the monk looked at this burglar and said, "When was the last time you ate?"
"None of your business."
"In the cupboard just above the donation box, there is some leftover food from today's lunch. Take some." And so the burglar took some food, stuffed that in his pockets with the cash. And the burglar looked at the monk and said, "Don't you call the police or I'll come back and burn down your temple." "I said, why should I call the police?" said the monk. "That I've given you this money, giving you this food, it's yours, go happily." And so the burglar ran away. And the following day, the monk told his committee what had happened to the money. And they all thought, what a wonderful thing that was. You know, a monk, an abbot who wasn't concerned how much money they made, but was actually a real monk, just, you know, giving, helping others. And so the committee were very happy with him. And then the next day, he looked in the newspapers and saw that burglar had been arrested, robbing another house, sentenced to 10 years in jail. 10 years later, the abbot woke up one morning. Someone was in the shrine room at 3 a.m. So he went in there to investigate. You know who it was. That burglar, out from prison, had come back again and had a knife. I was trying to open the donation box. Is that what happens? You know, you're kind to somebody once and they take advantage of you again. And so the burglar looked at the monk and said, "You remember me?" And the monk said, "Yeah, you're the burglar. Here's the keys. Help yourself." And at that, the burglar put his knife down and smiled. And he said, "I don't need the money. For the last 10 years I've been thinking about you while I've been in jail. You're the only person in my life who's ever kind to me, who gave me that money, saying to never ring the police, who, even though I was robbing your temple, was concerned that I was hungry and gave me food. I've been thinking of you, and this is the first place I've come now I've been released from jail. I realized the last time I came into your temple, I stole the wrong thing. Now I want to steal something more valuable. I want to steal your secret of kindness and generosity. Please ordain me." What do you really want? So when you find out what you really want, then it's not money. It's not food. Sometimes it's just a bit of kindness and friendship and peace. That's what we want. So that's the answer, that's what we want. Dear Ajahn, before I learned about Buddhism, I accidentally experienced my first nimitta during a meditation after a yoga session. I was shocked by the sudden spotlight and I saw white smoke during that meditation with my eyes closed. When asked, the yoga master told me that light was caused by the opening of my chakra, and the smokes are spirits. It was two years later that I came across your teaching and learned that it was a nimitta, and change of perception happens during deep meditation. Although I've never experienced nimitta again, I have gained more understanding and clarity now because of your teaching. Just want to say thank you, Ajahn, and I continue to let go and be patient and peaceful for the next nimitta to come. Thank you for reading, and feel free to comment, advise, if any. Weird but kind cat. We've got a picture of a cat on here. But it is true that sometimes the light is not opening of the chakra, it's just the energy of the mind coming through. You can call it opening of chakra if you want, but it's just the nature of the mind. It gets very, very bright. And white smokes during the meditation, that's just a way of perception. It's not a fire or anything. So it's not spirits. So, you know, when a person has got very good meditation and the nimitta come, the spirits can't get close to you. There was the daughter and son of this woman came a couple of days ago, Erica and Herbert. This was a Thai lady who, amazing woman, she was really worked hard and was one of the key supporters of the early days of our monastery. And her mother, she was Thai, her mother was alone in Thailand. So, you know, she managed to do all the paperwork to get a visa for her mother to come and stay in Thailand, come stay in Perth. Even though the mother couldn't understand any English, but I could speak to her in Thai, would always bring her for the dhanas into the monastery. And this girl, well, she had four children, and her son, who came the other day, he became almost like a celebrity chef. There was Herbert. There was a TV show called, I think, Iron Chef. I think, did they have that franchise, Iron Chef, over in?
MasterChef.
No, not MasterChef, it was called Iron Chef. And anyway, that I think it's the members of the public actually have to compete against real chefs. And he's the only one who's ever beaten the real chefs. So, you know, he was an amazing chef. And anyway, he was here the other day. You may have tasted his food. We get really looked after over at Bodhinyana Monastery. But anyway, Herbert's grandma, this Thai lady's mum, got very sick. We're in the hospital, and this Thai lady wanted to find out, you know, whether she's going to survive this illness or not, or whether this is going to be the last illness. So she hired one of these mediums, spirit doctors. It's only $20, really sort of good value for money. So $20, and she would leave her body, go on the astral plane, go and visit and find out whether this is the last sickness or not. So all she needed was $20 and the hospital, the ward and room number. And so that's what she did. She gave that number, and the spirit doctor just went into a trance, just, you know, went unconscious. And about 10-15 minutes later, when she came into consciousness again, returned to her body, the spirit doctor told her client, this Thai girl, here's the $20 back. Why? Couldn't you find my mum? Oh yeah, I found her. I found the hospital, found the ward, found the room, but I couldn't get inside. She said there was a huge force field around your mother, and I could not penetrate it. I'd never seen this before. Who is your mother? And the Thai girl said, my mother is a Buddhist nun. She's been on 8 precepts for about 30 or 40 years. At which point, the medium snatched back the $20. You should have told me beforehand. You've just been wasting my time. I'm taking the $20 back. People like me can't get close to people like that. I love the anecdote because that's what it feels like to spirits, ghosts. Now, if you are, you know, a really good person, you're keeping your precepts, that's how they see you, a big force field around you, they can't penetrate. So really, when I say you don't need to be afraid of ghosts, you know, they're afraid of you. Their force field is huge. So anyway, that's a nice little story there about the spirits can't get close to you. Well, John Brahm, I notice you have made a very radical change to the translation of the Satipatthana Sutra. In many versions of the translation, this phrase repeats again and again. Contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or both internally. The same goes for Vedana, Chitta and Dhamma. I think you're referring to there where it says, contemplating the body in the body, or the body as the body. And that is one of the basic grammatical mistakes of translating idioms. Because when you started learning Pali by reading it, and then you came across many, many, many times, you do body contemplation of body. You do path sweeping of paths. You do rice cooking of rice. It's just a way of Pali, a repetition. They make like a verb. You do nose scratching of noses. Where else would you do nose scratching, except on a nose? So in English, or maybe even Chinese, you know, you just use one word. You do house building of houses. That's like dishwashing. That's a good word. Can we use that? Dishwashing? What do you use dishwashing? You dishwash dishes. But in Pali, they would always say, you dishwash dishes. You do house painting of houses. So it's just the way of speech. There's nothing meant there except, you know, you've been contemplating the body, contemplating Vedana, contemplating the Chitta. So this is where sometimes being like a Westerner, you have the ability to challenge because it's not considered to be disrespectful to your teachers. Even when I was in Sri Lanka, giving big talks in Colombo to 10,000 people in BMICH, when people asked me, you know, did the Buddha teach the Abhidharma? I said, look, no, obviously, it's impossible. The evidence is so strong. And afterwards, the monks came and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. So why don't you teach that? We can't. Simply because, you know, we're not supposed to challenge our teachers. And so sometimes it happens that as a Westerner, you know, you do have a little bit more freedom to challenge things. Not just for the sake of challenging it, but you present the evidence, which is compelling. So there's many of the things, even with the Satipatthana Sutta, sometimes there's phrases which in Sri Lanka or in South Burma, if you try to change that, you get into big trouble, even though most people know it's correct, that, you know, these are good translations. So this is why, you know, you stand by the translation, always have to translate sentences, not words. Otherwise, you contemplate the body in the body. Where else would you contemplate the body? So you contemplate the body in the alarm clock. So after a while, you know, you understand the Pali, you read it. And again, good old Professor Warder said the only way you can really understand a language is read a lot of it. And, you know, don't follow too much of what other people say until you get to learn like Hokkien, like a child would learn Hokkien. You grow up with it. And that's how you know its meaning. Okay, why is it so difficult to let it go, even we understand and accept? I was sitting outside and feel how peaceful it is and realize for the last 5 minutes I've been thinking about job. Do we all have obsessive compulsive disorder to a certain degree? Is OCD something can be cured by meditation? Oh yeah, certainly it can. And it's obsessive compulsive disorder, it's just like fear. Apparently it is, young people have FMO, fear of missing out. So they always have to check their iPhones to see if there's a message there. Is it FOMO or is it FMO? No. FOMO, okay. Fear of missing out. So that, it's great to miss out. You miss out on so much suffering and so much stupid SMSs and tweets. And just, is that really important? Miss out on all that rubbish. You should be fear of missing out of peace and tranquility. So, to be able to let it go, sometimes you have to go against the stream. Be different. Not always be the same, and sometimes people will challenge you for that. Why don't you just fit in and be as crazy as everybody else in my office? And sometimes that if you are strong enough, courageous enough, you know, to make your own decisions, to walk your own path, rather than just being like, they say, the sheep following other people, people actually admire you and respect you. And they actually are jealous of you. Why can't I do that? Because they're afraid of criticism. They're afraid of, you know, being pushed out, of not being part of the group. There was one of our monks here. He was brought up in a farm close by. And he said that one day he went out to check up on the sheep. And he found, do you know how the sheep had managed to get into this difficult situation? They'd formed a circle around a thicket of bushes. So they couldn't see the other side of the thicket of bushes. They formed a circle, and they were, as sheep do, they were just following one another. Round and round and round, not realizing that this was an endless path they were following. They were just following the sheep in front. And it was around a circle. He said, you know how long they've been doing this? But thank goodness he could just pull one out of the circle to actually to break this, you know, following the one in front. And sometimes I feel like I'm like that, pulling a person out of the circle. So you can actually do something a little bit different and think, what am I doing this for? Round and round and round. Where does this lead? So why is it difficult to let go? Because of sometimes peer pressure. Sometimes fear, if I let go, everything will go wrong. But actually, if you let go, it doesn't go wrong. It goes really wonderful. You think, why didn't I do this before? To relax and let go. But even deeper than that, one of the reasons it's hard to let go, because if you really let go, it's your sense of self and identity starts to disappear. You know, you are, don't know who you think you are or how you describe yourself, but you know, all of your achievements, all the stuff you've managed to gain, you may be owner of a home, maybe you know that your family, your kids, what do you rate as your achievements? How do you define yourself? As for a monk, it's sometimes really difficult when we have to prove we exist. Every now and again, we actually have to go and get a new passport or something. And so you have to have these, what's it called, identity. You have a number of points to prove you are who you are. And I remember trying that once. And I tried it over the phone. I didn't have enough points to prove I was Ajahn Brahm. Because they asked me, you know, can you quote your bank account, your credit card, your rental agreement, or your ownership, or your marriage license, your driving license is a good one. And I said, I don't have any of those. And they said, well, you know, according to us, you haven't got enough points to prove your identity. You don't exist. And being a monk, you know, who are you anyway? You know, those are all the things by which the governments measure you. Well, what's your Facebook account? Don't have that. Mobile phone? No, don't have that. So, you don't exist as a monk. It's very difficult. So, if people ask me to have more ID, sometimes I don't. It happened once that I was traveling. I was in Melbourne Airport. And somebody had booked my ticket under the name of Ajahn Brahm. And my passport was Brahma Wangso. And he said, you know, this isn't you. You know, you can't get on the flight. And we need photo ID. And you know what came to my rescue? I actually had in my bag a copy of Opening the Door of Your Heart with a photo on the back and my name, Ajahn Brahm, in the front. And it worked. He said, oh, really? Oh, well, don't see why not. Okay. I got on the fly. So, but, yeah, someone's watching over me. Very good. But that's, who are you? And those are the things which define you in life. So when you let go, it's like, you know, you don't fit in, you don't belong, and you're not there anymore. Which is a bit scary. Ajahn. So, what was the other thing? I was giving this over in Renchi Hospital, I think last year. They wanted to do a talk that was on dementia. And so there was the doctor there, I forget what his name is. There's a sign, I've got dementia. And then the doctor's doing the medical side of it, and I did the spiritual side of it. And when the doctor was starting to talk about all of the signs of dementia, you remember that? What was the doctor's name? You cover, you got dementia too. It doesn't matter. Because anyway, the main signs of dementia were that, you know, you can't remember the past, you can't plan for the future, and you're socially disengaged. And I thought, hey, I've been teaching people to do that for the last 20 years. Let go of the past. No, stay by yourself. Solitude. So I'm the main cause of dementia in Singapore. But anyway, for one thing, when I was staying as a monk in Thailand, you know, you didn't have watches. I've got this clock over here. And it didn't know what day of the week it was. And it got to the point, I didn't know what year it was. You didn't need to, a nice simple life. Why do you want to sort of worry about years and time? And then, when I came to Perth, there was a gentleman who had an epileptic fit, so I had to call the ambulance. And the ambulance came, and I was just looking after him, and he was a Nepalese guy, Drupa his name was. I still remember his name, so maybe I haven't got dementia after all. But the first thing they asked him was, you know, what day of the week it is. He didn't know, so they put him straight in the ambulance. And that really scared me, because if they'd have asked me, I would have known either. I'd have got in the ambulance. So from that time on, I really tried hard to remember what day of the week it is. So what day of the week it is it, Claire? In the ambulance. So this is the way people judge people, because, you know, you watch TV, you watch and, you know, listen to news or whatever, so most people know what day of the week it is. As for, you know, monks and people outside the system, you don't know. Anyway, do Ajahn. Sotapanna and Vipassana both lead to samadhi when practiced well. Is there any sequence which comes first? Can you mix both in one meditation? Sotapanna and Vipassana both lead to samadhi. So Satipatthana, okay. Satipatthana, Vipassana. Satipatthana is Vipassana.
No, I think
someone got. Okay, lead to Samatha. Well, actually, they got Satipatthana and Vipassana both lead to Samadhi. It's basically, it's all the same. So Satipatthana, would have been tomorrow, but the next day, you see, Anapana Sati is the same as Satipatthana. And that's coming on Thursday. Is that the right day today? I've got to remember this, otherwise I guess I'll get into the... Yeah, on Thursday we'll do that one. So which comes first? They don't not want... You mix both in meditation? Exactly. You don't say what comes first, what comes next. They all just get... They dance together. You can't separate them. In the focus on Vedana, I experience. The sutta says, he abides, so there's no she here, just he, abides contemplating in Vedana, the nature of both arising and vanishing. Some teachers say this is the purpose of achieving equanimity. Is that so? It's actually more than equanimity. You see the nature of arising and vanishing, to see that they're out of control, you can't cause them, You can't just create sort of happiness in this world without having some suffering. And the idea of going to a heaven realm and living happily ever after is impossible. Because after a while, if you're in some heaven realm and then sort of it's happy, you wouldn't appreciate the happiness. You need some suffering to appreciate happiness. And even I think it was Saint Augustine, the Christian theologian, he said in Christian heaven, one day a year they have to go to hell for one day and spend the other 364 days in heaven. Otherwise they wouldn't appreciate what heaven is. It would just be ordinary. When some years ago when somebody asked me, he said, what do you think about the Pure Land? And I say, well, I remember reading about the Pure Land. Is whatever food you want, you can get. That's today. Takeaway, Uber Eats. You just get on your iPhone and you order it and it comes. Whatever entertainment you want, you get on the internet, on your iTunes, on Netflix. What else they've got? Whatever entertainment is just there for you. Whatever teaching of Dhamma you want. Amazing. You've got all these teachings just online. So this is the Pure Land. The Western Paradise. Where are you? Western Australia. Isn't this a paradise? Where you're in the presence of Amitabha Buddha? You've made it! This is the Pure Land! Congratulations! And you don't realize it! That's a trouble with heaven. Apparently, I thought that was really cool. I was inventing that, and some other Zen master got there before me about 20 years ago saying, this is the Pure Land. But, the whole idea is that you cannot have happiness without suffering. It's impossible. It was just, you wouldn't notice it. So why is the insight of arising and vanishing important for Vedana? It is because it shows you that it's causal, it can't last forever. When the causes vanish, so does the result. Just like you can't stay in China grow forever. When the course is finished, your visa runs out, you have to leave. When time is up. What was that story? There was, you know these little lakes or in like in parks where people take little boats to, you know, to actually have a row or a paddle in the lake for recreation on a nice sunny day. And they have little numbers on the boats and say, boat number 17, come in, your time's up. And then the person who's in charge said, boat 61, your time's up, come in. And boat 61 just made no response. Boat 61, come in, your time is up. Still no. So shall we laugh? Boat 61! And then the owner said, there is no boat 61. He said, boat 19, you've overturned and capsized. You haven't heard of one before, have you? No, there we go. Anyway, in the instruction of the five hindrances, the Buddha says, he understands there is sensual desire in me, he also understands there is no sensual desire in me. Is this a form of passive noting of mental qualities or the Buddha's way of dealing with the five hindrances? No, it's, they have the tense of the historic presence. So it, you know, it looks like it's a present tense, but it means you understand there was sensual desire in you. There was sloth and toff. There was restlessness. Because actually when you're in sensory desire, you don't realize it. You're not going to sort of come and contemplate it. And when you're in lust, you want that lust. When you want the food, you just go and get the food. Sometimes it's only afterwards you realize, oh no, I was just really entangled in my desires. So the key to that is just to understand that while you're really in the five hindrances, you can't understand them properly. You get some, maybe a little bit, I'm a bit sleepy, or, you know, I've got lust, or, you know, but you can't really sort of see the full picture there, because that's what the hindrances do. They distort your perception. What is it that really caused, but this is what happens, young men and young women going out. If they want a romantic evening, where do they go? They go for a candlelit dinner. Is that romantic? Yeah. Or go dancing in a nightclub. Yeah. Or go a walk by the river under the moonlight. That's romantic. Why is that romantic? What have those three situations, three locations got in common? They're dark. You can't really see what you're falling in love with. It's true. Because you just want that guy to, you know, look like this really strong, fine, wonderful person. You want the woman to look just so beautiful. No one ever falls in love in midday in the sunshine. You see all the faults in each other. But that's what happens, because our fantasies can play out and truth is like almost suppressed by the darkness. This is one of the ways where, you know, you understand, you see what you want to see. And the other thing with, especially aversion, hatred, sometimes you think, that person is just a real terrible person. You know, you can take someone. Look, take someone like Donald Trump. But you know, there's people who love him, who really care for him, who respect him. Which is the right Donald Trump? So it's so easy to get a stereotype, a picture of a person, and that's what you see. He's got a nice family. He's got people who really care for him. So there is another side to people. But sometimes we think that, oh, how could anyone like a person like that? And then you find people actually love them and care for them. Your boss from hell at work, he's got a family and kids who adore him. So sometimes, if I see someone who just, really, what does he do that? He's a really terrible person. Then you find there's people who love that guy or that girl. And that just starts making me thinking, just, am I only seeing part of the picture? You know, even, that's why in that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I wrote about a poem about your respect for your mother. You remember that poem? To love your mother. It said, even if your mother just, you know, basically causes you a headache, always asking for this and asking that, just give it to her with kindness. Because the day will come when your mother is gone and she can ask no more. So please give and serve and love her with kindness. Because the day will come and you regret that day that you didn't help her enough. And that's only just not really a match for the full poem. But the poem was quite moving about just, you know, love and care for your mum. But what was really the reason I put that in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, because the author was a gentleman called Adolf Hitler. The leader of the Third Reich. Because when I saw that, must be a mistake there. He couldn't have written someone like that. He did. So sometimes it's so easy that we can have aversion to someone and we don't know the full picture. We judge too harshly. You can't say he was a good person. It's terrible things which he did. But there's always a nice side to people. Fascinating. Anyway, oh, I've got two more quick questions. You define the phrase, having put away covetousness and greed for the world, as the overcoming of the hindrances. in a certain stage of stillness to be qualified to practice the four focuses of mindfulness, to overcome the hindrances like in the preliminary stage of meditation we practice mindfulness too. Is this mindfulness the same as the mindfulness we practice in the Satipatthana after putting aside the covetousness and grief of the world? It doesn't mean putting aside. It means actually reducing them. What I call restraining them. It doesn't mean that they are totally inactive. We've limited them enough. Reduce them enough so that we can be reasonably mindful. But later on it's the jhanas which really knock them out so we can have a long time to see what's really going on. Last question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I can feel my breath becoming more smooth and more subtle. More subtle as I've settled into the peace. But as I'm conscious of the breath coming from a body, I find that I can't progress further. I then fall back to focus on the breath that is originated by the body. Can you please advise what I should do? Thank you. Just stop breathing. Is that going to work? No, just don't think too much. You can feel the breath coming more subtle as I settle into the peace. But as I'm conscious of the breath coming from my body, I find I can't progress further. Don't just settle more into the peace. Go back to your peaceometer and just go more and more peaceful. And then the breath is just so calm, you actually can trust it. The breath knows what to do, whether it comes from a body, whether it comes from a lung, where it comes from. Just, I trust my breath. My breath has been looking after me for 67 years. It hasn't let me down yet. So, breath, you can do whatever you want. It's like trust. So, breath in, come in, go out, whatever you want to do. You know, sometimes the breath in meditation just stops for a little while. Breath will stop. Oh, I'm going to die. It's just you're taking a pause. It doesn't need any breath because you're so still. You know, your metabolism has gone down. And then it starts breathing again by itself. You just trust the breath to know how much it needs to take in air, when to stop, when to start. When you go to sleep at night, the breath just carries on even without any conscious effort at all. And it looks after you. It's an automatic process. So don't interfere with it. Just trust it. When I go on an aircraft, especially Singapore Airlines, I don't tell the pilot what to do. The pilot knows how to drive an aircraft, to pilot an aircraft. I just sit in my seat and relax to the max. And then you get to the destination, no problems. Imagine if I went up to the pilots, the cabin, knocked on the door and said, look, I'm in a rush today. I've really got to get to Singapore, you know, quickly today. Can you please, you know, step on the gas? Or if I said, oh, you know, have you ever seen Borobudur from the air? You know, because from Perth to Singapore, you go over Java. So I said, can you just, you know, go to a lower altitude, you know, so we can see Borobudur, and maybe just do three times around it, because it's a holy monument and you're a Buddhist? You can't do that. So my body, you know, my body pilots my life. So I just let the body do what the body needs to do. And I trust it. It's been well trained. And that way I don't get into trouble, the breath doesn't get into trouble, I can have a nice, peaceful meditation. So that is how, let the body breathe, it wants to breathe, doesn't want to breathe, doesn't have to breathe. How it breathes, it's the body's problem. Our job is just to observe, to watch, and not interfere. So if you're getting really peaceful, be peaceful. Enjoy it. Don't worry about where the body comes from. And sometimes that means that everything gets very nice, calm, peaceful, and you have a very happy time. So, that is the last question for tonight. There is more questions coming tomorrow. But because we're not going to do a sutta class tomorrow, most of the questions come from the suttas. So because we have not got a sutta class tomorrow, yay, we can have an early night tomorrow night. In my dreams. Sadhu, sadhu, Sad news. Very good. Okay, have a nice quiet night. But you don't have to. I don't control people. If you want to have a miserable night, it's fine by me. It's your choice. Very good. Whoa. Now, in north of Thailand, the northeast of Thailand, anyone who's over 60, you know, the elderly people, if they're a guy, they call them Po Oi. And if a girl, Me Oi. Now, Po means, you know, like uncle or grandfather, and Me means missus. And they call them Po Oi and Me Oi, because when they get up, Oi! Which is what some of you just did. They call it like that. Yeah, true, yeah.